How is it that we find ourselves surrounded by such complexity, such elegance?
The genes of you and me,
the genes of you and me,
we're all made of DNA. We're all made of the same chemical DNA.
Hi, you're listening to DNA Today, a multi-award-winning podcast and radio show where we discover new advances in the world of genetics. From genetic technology like CRISPR to rare diseases to new research, for over a decade, DNA Today has brought you the voices of leaders in genetics in over 200 episodes. For the past 3 years, DNA Today has won the People's Choice Best Science and Medicine Podcast Award. I'm Kira Dineen. I'm a certified genetic counselor and your host. We are continuing our peek into the past. Last episode, we explored the history of the genetic counseling field with Michelle Fox and Deborah Collins, who shared about the first annual National Society of Genetic Counselors, NSGC, conferences. In this episode, we are learning about the formation of the American Board of Genetic Counseling, aka ABGC. To dive into the story, my guests are Ann Walker and Ed Closa. Ann Walker has held many leadership positions, including the founding president and director of the American Board of Genetic Counseling, ABGC, which we are talking about on this episode. She's been the president of the National Society of Genetic Counselors, NSGC, back in 1982, and she's been on the board of directors for the American Board of Medical Genetics, American Society of Human Genetics, and the American Council for Genetic Counseling. During Ann's career, she's held roles at the University of California Irvine Medical Center, including as the program director for the Masters of Science in Genetic Counseling program for over two decades. She's authored over 20 peer-reviewed publications, 10 book chapters, and countless abstracts and presentations. Ann has been awarded many times throughout her impressive career, including the Natalie Weisberger-Paul National Achievement and Leadership Award from NSGC. Our second guest is Ed Closa. He was the first genetic counselor in Maine. He helped establish clinical genetics in Southern Maine and pioneered prenatal serum screening at the Foundation for Blood Research in Scarsboro. Ann was a member of the team from Women and Infants Hospital of Rhode Island, which published the first international clinic validation study of cell-free DNA screening. He was key in the development of the genetic counseling profession, including as the past president of NSGC, similar to Ann. He was the first and one of only two males elected in this position so far. He also was a huge help in creating the American Board of Genetic Counseling, which again, we're going to be focusing on in today's interview. In 2000, Ed was honored with the Natalie Weisberger-Paul National Achievement Award, another mutual award that him and Ann have earned. And currently, Ed is the genetics education consultant for the New England Regional Genetics Network, and he's an adjunct professor at Bay Path University with their graduate genetic counseling program. Want to become a genetic counselor? Looking for ways to engage with the field and boost your resume for grad school applications? Then you should check out Sarah Lawrence's Why Genetic Counseling Wednesday Summer Series. Every Wednesday this June, plus the last Wednesday in May, Sarah Lawrence is hosting a series where you can interact through Zoom with genetic counselors from different specialties. It kicks off on May 31st. You can sign up at slc.edu/DNA today. Again, visit slc.edu/DNA today to register to level up your resume for applications in the fall. Surely you've heard of whole genome sequencing, but what about rapid and ultra-rapid whole genome sequencing? This is an emerging method of diagnosing genetic conditions for quick management. PerkinElmer Genomics offers this incredibly valuable test, which can be life-saving for ill babies and kids. Learn more in our full episode with PerkinElmer Genomics on here, DNA Today. You can visit PerkinElmerGenomics.com for more information. The link is also available in the show notes and on our website, DNAtoday.com. So as I mentioned, last episode, we explored the history of the genetic counseling field with Michelle Fox and Deborah Collins, who shared about the first few annual NSGC conferences. And now we're talking about ABGC. So and do you mind starting us out and just kind of defining which each are? Because I remember when I was like starting in the field, I was very confused by like, what are these different organizations? What are their roles? Let's start anchoring people before we dive into, a blast from the past here.
Okay. Well, I think that for both the American Society of Human Genetics, the American Board of Medical Genetics, all of those are sort of different entities, and we have our parallels with NSGC. and in the genetic counseling community. But one of the ones that will figure prominently with this is the American Board of Medical Genetics, which is the board that certified physicians and other doctoral level individuals in medical genetics, human genetics. And the counterpart for the genetic counselors is the American Board of Genetic Counseling. Now, in addition to that, there are two professional societies. One of them is the American Society of Human Genetics, which was sort of the proto-organization for human genetics. And then we have our own professional organization with the National Society of Genetic Counselors. So those are the four main players. And then there is also the Organization for Nurses in Genetics, ISONG, and that one occasionally crops up. And I don't know, Ed, can you think of any others that belong in the alphabet soup?
No, I think, Ann, those are the those are the major players back in the day, and now.
And did you mention in that, I was like trying to keep track, but the board that looks at each genetic counseling school, it also starts with an A, I'm blanking.
Well, it's actually the American Board of Genetic Counseling, and that's going to become important later in the discussion, because that was one of the things that we hadn't been able to do before that was sort of a selling point for ABGC.
Right. And what you mentioned earlier was that originally genetic counselors were certified by the American Board of Medical Genetics, as were all genetic specialists at that time. So from my understanding, and please correct me if I'm getting things wrong, because that is important. But from what I understand, the first examination was like 1982 with everybody together, the MDs, PhDs, genetic counselors, all taking the same exam. And then there was like specialty exams on top of that. Can you correct me, kind of explain that a little bit better?
Yeah. There were two exams, and one of them was taken by all of the board takers. So that was the physician geneticists, the laboratory geneticists, the genetic counselors, and that was basic human genetics and medical genetics. So things that we expected everybody who was providing care to patients in one way or another to be able to know. Above and beyond that, there were clinical things for the clinical geneticists, so things based on how you would diagnose a condition, et cetera, and the laboratory people, the biochemical geneticists, the cytogeneticists had their own set of questions. Now, obviously, there was overlap because, you know, we were all supposed to know what a karyotype was and how to interpret them. So that was sort of the division of labor. And the American Board of Medical Genetics, in addition to certifying physicians and PhDs, also approved fellowship programs in medical genetics. And by the same token, we didn't really have any way of accrediting or genetic counseling programs. And at that time, there were lots of new programs that were starting up in varying combinations and permutations. And there was beginning to be some concern about whether, with all of this proliferation, there was going to be enough clinical training, for example, to go around. But nobody was accrediting genetic counseling programs. And so this was one of the things that we saw as a way to make apple juice out of sour apples, was that in addition to having our own credentialing board, that we also could accredit genetic counseling programs and make sure that there were uniform standards.
Yeah, very important today for programs to be able to be following up and making sure they're hitting the marks. That's why most genetic counseling programs, I guess all of them, have all the same classes. Like, that's something that I tell students that I'm like, if you're looking for differences between programs, don't look at the classes really. Unless they kind of have an elective. But I'm like, yeah, that shouldn't be first on your list to figure out what school you want to go to or what your favorites are. But yeah, for these exams, it's interesting because back in the day, was it that you would take it once and you're set for life? Because nowadays, like, I have to recertify every 5 years. Ed, can you comment on that a little bit?
Yeah, the early exams, Kara, were, as Ann indicated, you number one, you had to go there. You had to go somewhere because they were only offered in a few places across the country. So you had to schedule a trip. I went down from Maine down to New Haven at Yale, and you planned on spending the day. You had your general exam in the morning, took a break for lunch, and then we had the genetic counseling exam in the afternoon. And if you were certified, that was it. That was the only board that could certify genetic counselors was the American Board of Medical Genetics, and you were set for life. You were a member in good standing. You were a certified genetic counselor. You could put that on your business card or whatever, and it counted for quite a lot. There was nothing else that could be substituted for it at the time. Little did we know that things were about to change pretty drastically.
Yeah, so that big change, was that 1992, that like where ABGC was prompted, or is this something earlier?
Well, the American Board of Medical Genetics had been interested for a long time in applying to the American Board of Medical Specialties. Oh, there's another organization that we forgot to add.
You might have to have a list in the show notes. My goodness, it's like it'll be like a bingo board. As you hear them, you just kind of take them off.
Click it, you win. The American Board of Medical Specialties was the board that recognized it was a part of the American Medical Association. And if you wanted your medical specialty to be recognized, you had to apply for recognition by the American Board of Medical Specialties. And prior to genetics, the American Board of Medical Genetics applying, the last specialty to be accepted was back in 1979. And I think that was emergency medicine. So they don't do these things every year or every other year. You know, they only let you in when you apply. So it was a big thing. And certainly the American Board of Medical Genetics figured that, gee, it's time that we applied to have medical genetics recognized as a medical specialty and not just a little appendage off of obstetrics or pediatrics or wherever else you happen to be practicing genetics. And so when they applied to the American Board of Medical Specialties, the American Board of Medical Specialties said, sure, come on in, but let's take a look at your membership list. Oh my gosh, who are all these master's level people here?
You know, yeah, they're not a doctor. What are they doing on the list?
No. And where are all these PhDs doing on the list? We don't even like them. We don't even want them. We, you know,
MD or nothing.
This is a medical association, and we want to recognize a medical specialty, not all these other people. And when they let genetic counselors know that the only way they could be recognized, medical genetics could be recognized as a medical specialty, was for the genetic counselors to get off of the membership list of the ABMG. Well, you can imagine the response that came out of the genetic counseling community. It was not well received.
Yeah, I can imagine there was a lot of discourse between the doctors, like the MDs, the PhDs, genetic counselors. I imagine there was a lot of different feelings and conversations around that time.
Oh boy. Yeah.
And it's like, how much time do we have to get into all the
and
tea?
Even within, I mean, there was certainly the genetic counselors as a group were not happy about the idea of giving up their ABMG membership, because they worked for it. They worked for it as hard as the MDs and the PhDs. They earned it. They were
taking the same exam. Like, they had to know the same level.
Taking the same exams, putting the same amount of work in, et cetera. And they said, well, how is it that you can just essentially kick us out? Well, as it turned out, the membership of the ABMG, the number of genetic counselors that were members, if they had voted as a block not to remove themselves from the membership list, they could have prevented medical genetics from being recognized, because the American Board of Medical Specialties says, if you don't get rid of these master's level people, you can't come in. We'll accept PhDs because there was a precedent for that with radiation medicine. But this is absolutely non-doctoral level folks.
Yeah.
So they didn't want us. And even among genetic counselors, the genetic counseling community, there was a tremendous amount of hostility because there was a faction that said, you know, this is something we got to do, we ought to do, it's time for us to do it, get out on our own. And there was a group that says they have no right. If they're going to kick us out, then they have to leave the ABMG as well. Let us each form a new group. And medical specialty people says, no. That's just too complicated.
I think that one of the things that made it a little bit distinct from other medical specialties, and I'm talking in the Broadway here, is the fact that medical genetics had always been practiced as a team effort and sort of co-equal team, and we all recognized each other's strengths, and we would see patients together, and they'd say, now the genetic counselor is going to stay with you and, you know, go through this information, and we might be assisting at the exam or whatever. And it really sort of threatened the entire practice model for medical genetics. And I think that was one of the things that was really distinct about our collective profession and orientation that we didn't want to lose. And I think a lot of the physicians and PhDs who were going to be able to be to stand for certification really felt that they were betraying the counselors to some measure. But on the other side of that, of course, was the eagerness to have their own specialty recognized by the greater medical community. And
I can definitely see both sides. Like, yeah. I can't imagine how different things would be if this didn't happen. So how close was this vote in the end?
No. Really. It was overwhelming vote in favor of the separation, and that included certainly most of the genetic counselors have had to have voted to separate. And I think one of the things that struck me and that it impacted me, I was president of the NSGC at that when all that started, and prior to my being elected in 92, and Diane Baker was elected in 87, and during her presidential address, she quoted a French writer, Guillaume Apollinaire, really stuck to me. It always has, it always will. It's a brief poem. "Come to the edge," he said. "We can't. We're afraid," they responded. "Come to the edge," he said. "We can't. We might fall," they responded. "Come to the edge," he said. And so they came, and he pushed them, and they flew. At the time that we were going through this with the ABMG, I think a lot of us were thinking, this is the time. We're being pushed to the edge. We're being pushed out of the nest, and it's time. To the something of the ABMG and the other professional organizations, they made provisions to take care of the genetic counselors and said, look, we'll give you, I don't know, I think it was $250,000 during the separation. It's kind of like a divorce. It's often referred to as a divorce. Yeah. And we'll give you this $250,000. It'll help you start your own organization. And we put together a restructuring committee, and Ann was in charge of that. And that was the beginning of the American Board of Genetic Counseling, and we had a group of dedicated folks led by Ann that spent, you know, blood, sweat, and tears to get this thing up and running. And
see this hair color? That changed that year.
Is that what it's from, forming the ABGC?
I went from ash to white in a year and a half.
Oh, my goodness. So, yeah, let's dive into that a little bit more, Anne. So you, as Ed was saying, you had an integral role in starting ABGC. What were some of these challenges as you started? I mean, to me, that sounds like a big chunk of money at this time to be starting it. But I don't know. I don't have a reference for how much organizations need to get started.
Well, it wasn't so much starting the organization. I mean, you can get a bunch of people together and, you know, have an organization without cash. You can't give a board examination without cash. And it's a very expensive proposition because, first of all, you've got to have an agency that has some sort of credibility that is going to manage this thing and take care of all of the security and, you know, the printing and all of the nuts and bolts and the examination centers. So that piece of it was hugely expensive. And we were starting de novo, too. We didn't have some mysterious bank of questions, you know, that we could recycle every so often. And in genetics, you can't recycle them very often anyway, because they're out of date. So
I'm sure the questions you've written, maybe there's a couple that are still there, but, you know, yeah, maybe more the ethical side of things. But yeah, like you have to keep rewriting them. Yeah, it's a really good point. Yeah. It's not math.
That's true. So, I mean, and not only that, you don't have really a critical mass of people in any part of the country that can do that. So you got to get them together, and you got to get them together for a chunk of time to work on those things. So that was just the mechanics of creating a new board exam, much less an organization. And, you know, I don't think we had any major concerns about our ability to do that. We'd been writing the, you know, part of the general exam for years, genetic counselors had, and we'd all been taking the same exam. But the genetic counseling questions and how we wanted to do that was a little bit different. So it also occurred to us that as a credentialing board, in as much as the physicians and PhDs approve the training programs, that this might be an avenue where we could get a twofer, and we could also start an accrediting body along with the credentialing body. And I think that that was perhaps one of the things that made it a less bitter pill for people to swallow, because there were lots and lots of new programs cropping up at the time, and it wasn't clear that they really had been part of the culture long enough to understand some of what we believed was important in training genetic counselors. And so beginning to establish accrediting standards was another part of that would have added a lot to the expense.
So how long did this take to, like, once ABGC started forming, just from that point to now we're offering our own genetic counseling exam? How many years did that take?
Well, there wasn't a huge hiatus because people needed to be certified. And
okay, that's a good point. You had a fire under you.
ABMG at that point was offering the exam every other year. And I think we decided that we could do it once every 3 years. Was that it, Ed? I can't remember.
I believe so. And we started, Ann started putting this thing together, and developing the infrastructure for the ABGC before we even separated. So we did it in anticipation of that happening. And one of the stipulations was any genetic counselor who held membership in the American Board of Medical Genetics would retain their membership, and they could always call themselves board certified by the ABMG, but they weren't really a member of the board that was recognized.
They weren't voting members, right?
Yeah, they're not voting members, but they still retain it. And they also were automatically, if they wanted to be, grandfathered or grandmothered or grandparented into the new ABGC instantly. So if you were a member of the ABMG, you were a member of the ABGC. Boom, no problem.
And so that meant you didn't have to recertify, like you were, like as you said, grandparented in. I like that term. So you didn't, for you guys, you didn't have to submit every few years. You never had to retake the exam. Like you were part of that generation, right?
We were lucky.
Yeah.
I mean,
right. Yeah. And obviously you've stayed up on the field and everything, but yeah, I can see why that's not a thing now, because if you are not active in the field, a lot changes in 5 years. So I think it makes sense, you know, to have that be a requirement.
And it's interesting because at that time, licensure didn't exist for genetic counselors either. And, you know, it was very useful to have that credential from ABMG to sort of legitimize that. And obviously it is a requirement for licensure in most states that you keep your certification up.
Yeah, and more states are being added to that list. Hopefully we get to the point where all of them are and legislation is passing for that. If you're applying to genetic counseling grad schools in the near future, I highly recommend checking out Sarah Lawrence's Why Genetic Counseling Wednesday Summer Series.
This is the fourth year Sarah Lawrence will be hosting this series, where you can interact through Zoom with genetic counselors from different specialties for 2 hours every Wednesday in June. It actually kicks off on Wednesday, May 31st at noon Eastern. As many of you know, I graduated from Sarah Lawrence's program 3 years ago, and this series was a fun way to interact with prospective genetic counseling students, and I'm really looking forward to meeting more of you during this series. Myself and fellow genetic counselors will share about our roles and answer your questions live. Not only will you hear from GCs in a variety of specialties, you'll also have the opportunity to discuss ethical and social implications of genomic medicine, engage with current students, and learn about the exciting present and projected future of the profession. Anyone who attends all five will earn a certificate of completion and receive an application fee waiver for the grad program in the fall. Register now before we are fully booked. Go to slc.edu/DNA today. Again, that's slc.edu/DNA today to be part of this interactive genetic counseling experience. Genetic technology moves fast. The first genome took 13 years to finish a draft. For reference, this was 20 years ago in 2003. And now, a whole genome sequence can be performed in days, even hours. Since sequencing an entire genome can be done in such a short amount of time, this lowers the cost, which means more people can utilize whole genome sequencing now. This is particularly helpful in the NICU for ill infants. Kirk and Elmer Genomics explain more to me in our full episode here on DNA Today. It is remarkable how quick diagnosis from whole genome sequencing can save a baby's life with a change in treatment informed from the results of that test. I learned more about how genome data is mined to maximize useful information from one data set and other omic assays that help enhance diagnosis. Don't miss the full episode here on DNA Today. You can visit PerkinElmerGenomics.com for more information. The link is also available in the show notes and on our website, DNAtoday.com.
Were there any other key players in this? I mean, I'm sure there was others, but any off the top of your head that were really instrumental other than the two of you in forming ABGC?
Who were members of the restructuring team? I know it was Debbie Collins.
So she was on last episode. Yep.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Joan Scott.
Diane
was part
Baker.
Of it.
Diane Baker
was
Diane
part
Baker.
Of it.
Another familiar name. Yeah.
Beth Fine.
Yeah, because then when we got into the credentialing, mm-hmm. Beth Fine was instrumental. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. All the OG players in our field. Yeah. Like I was saying in the last episode, you go to NSGC, you go to all these different lectures, like named after. You know, the OG genetic counselors. It's like, these are the people you're mentioning. It is cool that, you know, the field started with just so few of you that, you know, I imagine a lot of you really know each other well at this point. So give us a little bit more in terms of what the first few years of ABGC were like as you guys were finding your footing. And were there other issues? I mean, with the field being so small, like, was there any conflict of interest with accrediting the programs? Because I imagine some people that were involved with ABGC were also program directors and things like that. I imagine a lot comes up when you only have so many people in the field.
Well, and you were a program director as well, weren't you? Or
yeah, I think those of us who were program directors, and Diane had been, and Beth had been, and, you know, I think we certainly had the long view, but I think we were also acutely sensitive to the fact that, you know, we had been put on there for a task and not to, you know, police the field. And so it was more about setting up a mechanism for accreditation. And, you know, even nuts and bolts like writing bylaws took an inevitable, you know, quite a bit of stomach lining. And, you know, it was a nuisance, but you wanted to get it right. And by the time that we started accrediting programs, obviously you could bring in a lot more people. It wasn't just the board that was doing it. You had examiners, you had people that would go out and make the site visits, you would, you know. So it was much more democratic at that point, and it wasn't something that the board, you know, just said, oh, we're going to, you know, wave a wand and say that you're accredited.
Right. I imagine you all have the same goal of, like, we want the genetic counseling field to be as the best that we possibly can be. So there'd be no point in kind of having it be like, oh, minimal requirements, like almost the opposite effect I can see happening.
Yeah, and not only that, I mean, you know, the field had changed. I mean, you know, for the first 10 years of Ed's in my profession, I'm sure we had to have this preamble of what's a genetic counselor. By the time
Very
this all came
so.
Down, you know, it wasn't a novel concept to a lot of people. You still had to explain yourself a lot. Go ahead, Ed. I'm sorry.
And I think, Kara, the other thing to appreciate is that at the time that we were going through this, the separation from the ABMG and the creation of the ABGC, this was an existential situation for us, because had things gone wrong, it could have been the end of genetic counseling and genetic counselors. If we had refused to let the ABMG release us and medical genetics did not get accepted as a medical specialty, the relationship between genetic counselors and our doctoral level colleagues would be changed, and not for the better. And it was the months of discussion and debate and pain and angst that we went through, the blood, sweat, and tears, it worked out. And when we came through this and created the ABGC, got licensing, got the Journal of Genetic Counseling, all these wonderful things that were happening to our profession and the growth in our profession, you know what that's like. Our profession is safe, it's healthy, it's vibrant, and, you know, thank God that it went the way it did. Yeah.
Yeah, no, it is a very important thing looking back. It's like, you know, I'm sure you felt the importance at the time, but now looking back, probably like even more so, as you're saying, like, wow, how things would be different now, decades later. So I want to ask a question that I asked last episode to Michelle Fox and Deborah Collins, is if you went back in time to ABGC starting decades ago, if you could go back in time to yourself, what would surprise you most about the genetic counseling field? If you were like, hey, in 2023, this is going to be in existence, either something about the profession, technology, patient advocacy, like anything that's related. Is there anything that would really surprise you if you were, you know, had that time machine?
I'll just say that the number of programs, the number of genetic counselors, the number of people wanting to be genetic counselors, the respect and authority and status that genetic counselors have in 2023, I don't think I would have appreciated back then. It would have blown me away.
Yeah, because we surpassed 5,000 genetic counselors. What was that, last year or something like that? So anything else to add to that, Anne? I think that was a good wrap-up, yeah.
No, I think the other place that genetic counselors have become integral is in the diagnostic laboratories. And, you know, those have proliferated like crazy with the whole era of DNA testing and more. And, you know, I think essentially nobody would think of having a genetics laboratory, a clinical genetics laboratory, without having a genetic counselor. And that was, you know, just kind of window dressing at that time. I mean, we knew how to work with laboratories, but we weren't an integral part of them. And I think that that's been a real sea change.
Yeah, that think, is true. It used, you know, to be just clinic, but now yeah. GCs are working in the labs. Yeah.
Right. Yeah. Clinic or administration of public health programs. So I think, you know, the newborn screening programs and all of those, you know, find that this is a really important piece of it. So,
yeah, well, I think that's very well said. Thank you both for coming on and sharing all of your expertise. I mean, this is such a treat to be able to talk with both of you. And Deborah and Michelle from last episode, I mean, it's just like very cool to be able to talk to people that started the genetic counseling field and all the roles that you guys have. So on behalf of all 5,000 genetic counselors now and counting, thank you so much for being part of forming ABGC, making, you know, this integral decision to be separate. Because as Ed was really highlighting and having us appreciate that, we would not be where we are today without it. So just seriously, thank you.
Well, we're reassured when we see the next generation coming along too, because it's, yeah, you know, on the one hand, it's a little awkward to feel like an antique. On the other hand, it's very exciting to see the enthusiasm and the quality of people who are coming up. So
Right. We can use the word seasoned. You're a seasoned, you know, genetic counselor. I think that's what we start seeing. Because once you hit a certain decade of like experience to write in your resume, it's like, oh, I'm just going to write seasoned, you know? Like, but no, that's just, thank you both so much for coming on. I so appreciate it.
Okay. Thank you, Kara. I will email you.
If you're one of the listeners that tunes into DNA Today every week here, then you definitely know by now that we have launched our Patreon. This is where you can not only get bonus content from DNA Today, you can get early access to episodes before the public. You can also influence the content of the show. This includes episode topics and guests, even pitching questions I ask during interviews. And of course, I'm going to give you a shout out when I ask your question. And if you sign up by May 25th, so limited time offer, you're going to get a bonus physical gift that I will send you in the mail. For these benefits and more, you can visit our Patreon. Link is in the show notes and on our website, dnatoday.com. As many of you know, through podcasting, I've become an entrepreneur, including consulting for other podcasts. Since I don't have a business degree, I've learned a lot through podcasts like Porch Talks. The inspiration to start this show was from the host, Melissa Bradley, who wanted to inform, instruct, and inspire fellow entrepreneurs, especially people who identify as women, people of color, immigrants, veterans, people with disabilities, and folks in the LGBTQIA+ community, which drew me initially. So if you're thinking about starting a business or just love hearing stories about how businesses grow, Porch Talks is for you. Search Porch Talks in your podcast player or use the links in the show notes to start listening. For more information about today's episode, visit dnatoday.com, where you can also stream all 200 plus episodes of the show, including video versions of interviews recorded in 2021 or later. Any questions, episode ideas, guest pitches, or sponsor inquiries can be sent into info@dnatoday.com. Be sure to follow us on social media, especially so you don't miss a giveaway. We are at DNA Today Podcast on Twitter, Instagram, LinkedIn, Facebook, and more. Please rate and review the podcast on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you listen. This truly helps us climb the charts and allow more genetic nerds like yourself to find the show. Here's a bonus. If you do and send us a screenshot, I'll give you a shout out on the show. DNA Today is created, hosted, and produced by myself, Kira Dineen. Our team includes communications lead, Corinne Merlino, video lead, Amanda Andrioli, outreach intern, Sonia Tanaker, social media intern, Kajal Patel, and graphic designer, Ashlyn Anokian. Thanks for listening, and join us next time to discover new advances in the world of genetics.
The genes of you and me, the genes of you and me, we're all made of DNA. We're all made of the same chemical DNA.